Hello, it's Wednesday, January the 21st. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Daily Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, a report that reveals, guess who does most of the homeschooling during the lockdown? You wouldn't be surprised if I tell you, it's not the dad. The number of people testing positive for COVID antibodies, it's now 1 in 8. That is good news because it's helping us build up herd immunity. The record-breaking polar adventurer Louis Rudd, he's only the second person to ski solo to Antarctica, is now planning an even more hair-raising trip. But first, Theresa May, in the Daily Mail today, accusing Boris Johnson of a lack of global leadership and telling him he's got to strike a positive relationship with Joe Biden, who is the new President of the United States. Theresa May, in her first newspaper article since she stood down as Prime Minister, has issued her most strident criticism of Boris Johnson. She's accused him of abandoning Britain's position on global moral leadership. She wrote this piece to mark Joe Biden's inauguration in the United States. She said her successor has failed to honour British values by threatening to break international law in Brexit trade talks. If you remember, he was threatening to depart from the withdrawal deal struck with the EU. And he's also ripped up the foreign aid target of spending 0.7% of our gross domestic product on international aid. I wonder if her views strike a chord with many Tory MPs. Joining me now is one of them. He's Andrew Bridgen. He is the Conservative MP for North West Leicestershire. Andrew, I'm always surprised when a Prime Minister who was bundled out of office because she was perceived to be not a great leader by you and your colleagues, then lecture somebody who won a pretty big majority in December 2019 in the form of Boris Johnson.
Yes, and I think I was deeply concerned when Theresa May didn't stand down from Parliament after she was no longer Prime Minister. There's an old saying in politics, there's nothing more ex than ex Prime Minister. And she appears to haunt the back benches of the Conservative Party like Banquo's ghost after the murder. I think it's
some people would argue it's rather good of her to stay on as backbencher. She's got lots of experience. She was a Home Secretary for a very long time. She's been Prime Minister. She can be a source of advice to her successor.
Well, maybe. That may be her perception. I think she's, having read the article, it's dripping with bitterness and venom. And it's bringing back not my own personal memories, but collective recollections of Edward Heath sitting on the back benches during Margaret Thatcher's time as Prime Minister.
Yeah, and that was the longest sulk in political history. We can't have that.
We now need some optimism. I think Theresa May has broken one of the first rules of being a Conservative member of Parliament, is that you try to avoid blue-on-blue clashes in public, and she's gone, there's very little things more public than the front page of the Daily Mail. I think it reflects rather badly on her judgment to do that. But she's clearly staked out her position, but her position, from my perspective, is very weak. I mean, had we gone along with Theresa May's Chequers deal, which I think I was the first MP to put my vote of letter of no confidence publicly in, 2 days after the Chequers deal arrived, because as an arch Eurosceptic, I would have rather voted for us to stay in the European Union than accept the Chequers deal, because at least when we were in the European Union, we could leave. We would have become a vassal state. Instead of taking back control, we would have been effectively a colony of the EU, and that treaty would have been forever. So there would have been no way of ever escaping from it. It was a complete disaster and a betrayal of everything we promised the British people and everything that they voted for in the referendum. So that is her position. And the sad thing is, she still seems to believe that her deal was a good deal. And she talks about compromise and, we've got... I thought she was going to go off into sort of toxic masculinity at one stage and accuse Boris of that. And it's all right, this compromise with, on the world stage, but also being a Conservative. I mean, what we credit the Conservative Party with is that we know how the world is, we know how the world we'd like it to be, and it's a fatal mistake to get the two mixed up. And the world isn't like that. If Boris hadn't stood his ground and threatened the introduction of the Internal Markets Bill when the EU negotiated in very bad faith. And I mean, who saw the withdrawal agreement as being interpreted as allowing the EU to effectively blockade Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK and potentially bring in tariffs between the UK mainland and Northern Ireland? I mean, that was what they were threatening us with. And people threaten you, you have to respond. Boris didn't actually break the international law, because all that legislation did was give the minister the ability to take the powers in the event of a no-deal Brexit where they blockaded Northern Ireland. Well, I mean, that seems like a reasonable response. At the end of the day, if your opponent's fighting in the gutter, you sometimes have to get down and dirty with them.
And just finally, what of Theresa May? You make the point you'd have preferred if she'd followed convention. Gordon Brown, Tony Blair, Mrs. Thatcher all went pretty quickly after they'd left Number 10. If you had advice for her, she's given advice to Boris Johnson in the Daily Mail today. What advice would you give to Mrs. May, Andrew Bridgen?
Well, I think what we always thought, what Theresa May was seen as, was she wasn't someone that people warmed to, but they respected, and they thought that she was, you know, had moral principles. And part of that is that you don't criticise so unfairly someone who's your successor. That's an easy thing to do. It actually diminishes Theresa May as a politician, not only within the Conservative Party but within the country. Boris has had a very difficult premiership. He's had some massive challenges: Brexit, COVID. We can see the light at the end of the tunnel, and now's the time for moving forward together. But I'm afraid I don't think Theresa May's actually on the team, having read the article today. And I think the public will come to judge whether the decision to remove her from office was the right one. I think the article, unfortunately, she's written today only demonstrates that it was.
Indeed. That's Andrew Bridgen. He's the Conservative MP for North West Leicestershire. Thanks for joining us. So remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News, and you'll get the latest from Mail Plus. And at 5, of course, you get to hear the latest Daily Show. Around 1 in 8 people in England alone have COVID, according to official figures. Testing by the Office for National Statistics found the number of people with a degree of immunity to the virus has also doubled between September and December. On top of the 1 in 8, 7.5 million, another 1 in 15, more than 4 million people have been vaccinated. What should we make of these figures? Lawrence Young is Professor of Molecular Oncology at Warwick Medical School. Professor Young, what do we make of the fact so many of us have already had COVID? Are we developing a form of herd immunity, that expression that we heard right at the beginning of the pandemic, and then it disappeared?
Yeah, well, it looks like we're heading in that direction. The study shows that infection with the virus is much, much more widespread in the United Kingdom than we previously realised. And, of course, this is all about folks who have asymptomatic infection or very mild symptoms developing a strong antibody response.
And just really remind people what it means when people have you detect an antibody in someone who's had COVID.
Yeah, so the body's immune system has a number of different elements to it. A very important part of the immune system when it comes to virus infections are these antibodies, which will bind to the virus and prevent it infecting. So you generate that response, and that means that you are protected for a period of time from reinfection. And it's a type of response that we're trying to trigger with the various vaccines that are now being used in the UK. So it's one very important part of the body's ability to essentially wipe out virus infection.
A lot of people say, and they say it to me because I went down with this wretched thing way back in April. It seems entirely another world, I have to tell you that, Professor. But a lot of people say, oh, you're all right, you've had it, you're okay. But that's not right, is it? Because the immunity that the antibodies give some protection for, is it maybe 5 or 6 months after you've gone down with the virus? And then are we susceptible or vulnerable to getting it again?
Yeah, there are a couple of concerns about that. We know that these types of viruses, this particular family of virus, can result in a strong immune response to start with, but it wanes after a few months. And the study the so-called Siren study that was published last week demonstrates that up to 5 months, and they've only followed people for 5 months, you still see good antibody responses in the majority of people. But we know that these antibody responses will wane after a period of time. And that's an issue, too, to be honest with you, with the vaccine, about whether or not we will need to have repeated vaccinations.
Well, we have a flu jab. We're encouraged, aren't we, to have a flu jab every year. Do you think when this wretched thing is under control that the COVID vaccine will become as routine as the flu jab in public health?
I think it's going to go that way. I mean, we have another niggly-naggly over the last week or so because we're hearing more and more about these virus variants. We know one is circulating in the population in the UK. And my belief is the data that we're just discussing today about antibody responses and the enormous increase, because antibody levels have doubled in England since the summer, that tracks the second wave of infection. But a lot of that is driven by this virus variant. Unfortunately, the variant that has arisen in South Africa and a separate variant that's in Brazil looks like it doesn't actually respond as well in terms of the body's immune response. And so there is a slight concern that these variants may result in higher levels of reinfection. And that would be another thing we need to do in terms of considering modifying an annual vaccine. We may need to change it a little bit, tweak it so that it can see these variants that are popping up.
We've heard that there is evidence that the great success so far of the rollout of the vaccine, Professor, has slowed down a little. For the second day running now, the number has fallen below, I think, 300,000. The suggestion is that Pfizer, who are renovating their factory in Belgium to try to enhance production, you do wonder perhaps why they might not have done that upgrade of the factory earlier. But is that your understanding of why it slowed down, or are there problems actually developing with the way it is being distributed?
I think it's a bit of both. I think it's quite clear that we're going to have supply issues. Remember, these vaccines are being distributed all over the place. Lots of other countries are bought into these vaccines, and the sheer pressure on manufacturing capacity is an issue. We know that from the very beginning. We certainly know that we don't have that capability within the UK. So that's a problem. And I think there's lots of logistical issues. I live in the West Midlands. There have been some really interesting issues over the last 24 hours where certain parts seem to be able to access the vaccine and other parts can't. And I think I can understand that's a sort of logistical issue, but I think there were always going to be, as you say, bumps in the road with this. It's quite clear that supply is a major issue.
All right. That's Lawrence Young. He's Professor of Molecular Oncology at Warwick Medical School. Thanks so much for joining us. So if you enjoy The Daily Show, why don't you subscribe to us? Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify, and you get in touch by emailing us at dailyshow@mailplus.co.uk or follow us at mailplus. So no wonder so many mums are fed up with homeschooling, because it appears dads are failing to pull their weight. Research has found that just 12% of fathers are taking the lead on helping children in the lockdown. That's according to the education company Plan B. A survey of hundreds of parents of primary school age kids found that parents are spending up to 4 hours a day educating children. But guess what? Mum is shouldering most of the burden. I'm joined by Ollie Ryan, who is a writer at Plan B, who is, of course, a former primary school teacher. Ollie Ryan, it's you lot. It's you men. You're not doing what you're supposed to. You're not pulling your weight.
I know. Slap on the wrist for me.
Did these results surprise you?
Partly, yes. Yes. I think it's no surprise that mothers are doing a majority of the homeschooling with the children during the school closures, but we were surprised to find out that just so few fathers were involved.
What do you put that down to?
I think there are a number of factors. With primary age children in particular, I think it's slightly less surprising that mothers are doing more of the home education because of all of the things that we know about children of that age, which is that mothers tend to do a lot more of the parental leave, obviously, and deal with childcare, that kind of thing. And fathers with younger children of that age tend to be the ones who continue to work uninterrupted.
But I would have thought in lockdown, Ollie, those traditional
demarcation lines would break down more, because often mum and dad are going to be at home with the children, in which case dad could pick up some of the slack and give mum a break. But it appears that didn't happen, certainly in the first lockdown.
It seems that way, yes. I think perhaps one of the reasons that we didn't see that, or what we found from speaking to parents during the first lockdown, is perhaps because these furlough measures weren't in place at the time. Of course, now either parent can request furlough from their employer if they have childcare commitments because of school closures. So I'd be very interested to find out if things have changed this time round. I suspect there hasn't been a great deal of change, though.
Yeah, and also, should we be encouraged by the fact that over a quarter say they spent more than 4 hours a day, this is presumably mums, helping the kids with their schoolwork? That's a big chunk of a working day, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And wonderful for the children that so many parents seem to be able to do that. It does seem to me to be rather a lot of time to be spending in this very difficult situation, though. One of the things that we've picked up on, sort of anecdotal evidence talking to some of our home educators using Plan B, is that schools are sending home significantly larger amounts of work this time round, and that it's difficult to cope with this increased workload this time round. I'm not sure if 4 hours a day is a good fit for many families. Fantastic for those who can, but I'm not sure that would work for everybody.
Just finally, Ollie, dads will be listening to this, mums will be listening to this too. What advice have you got to those dads who, either for practical reasons, they say they haven't got the time, or they just think they're not cut out for it and it's mum's job, or mum is better emotionally suited to taking the burden of the childcare, the child tuition? What advice would you give to those dads? How can you make it appear to dad a more attractive thing for them to be doing?
Well, as a former teacher, I can say that it's very, very rewarding. Actually, working with the children was one of my absolute favourite parts of the job. So I think it would certainly be rewarding, and it's perhaps an opportunity, albeit one that's been forced upon us or many of us, but it is an opportunity to experience something with your children that you may not experience again for a while. And I think if they're anything like me and my experiences working with children, they will find it very enjoyable, exhausting, but enjoyable.
All right, that's a good advice from Ollie Ryan, who is a writer at Plan B, which has done this survey. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm always in awe when I speak to people like Louis Rudd, because not only is he a former officer in the Royal Marines, former member of the SAS, the crack elite squad, he's also the first Briton and only the second person overall to ski solo across Antarctica, which makes me feel incredibly inadequate when I feel incredibly chuffed when I manage to do my 12,000 steps in a day. Louis Rudd joins me now. Where did you get your daring do instincts from, Louis Rudd? Because you've led a team of army reservists across Antarctica, which took you 67 days. You've served for the Royal Marines in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it seems no challenge is too great for you.
Yeah, I think I was inspired from a really young age. I remember I was about 12 years old, and I'd actually got myself in a bit of trouble at school. I'd been sent to see the headmaster, and I was sat outside his office in this reception room waiting to go in to be caned, actually, and pretty terrified. And there was a little bookshelf off to the side while I was sat there waiting. I just randomly grabbed this book, and it was a little ladybird book titled Captain Scott. And at that point, I'd never heard of, you know, Captain Scott, polar explorers, you know, Antarctica. It wasn't covered in the school curriculum. And I just remember flicking through this book and looking at these, you know, incredible images and reading the story of this amazing expedition and these guys, you know, their life and death struggle to try and be the first people to reach the South Pole. And I just found it really inspiring, and, you know, instantly thought, yeah, you know, I want to go down to this place and just experience a polar journey for myself. And carried on then reading more polar history as I was growing up, and the likes of Shackleton and Amundsen. So yeah, you know, I think that's what it was. I kind of role models from a young age.
Royal Marines. I think you were quite young when you joined up. You were 16, I think.
The earliest, you know, the youngest you can join, straight out of school, finish my O levels, and then signed up to join the Marines for a life of adventure.
And do you think it was the military discipline of the Marines, 3 decades in the Marines, that enabled you to do that first trip to Antarctica? What was that, back in 2011, 2012? You skied 800 miles over 67 days, unsupported.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I think definitely being in the military has helped with not only, I guess, my physical sort of robustness, but I think more importantly, my mental robustness and sort of, I guess, being used to taking on very sort of challenging things in the military, then transferred across into the exploration world. So I think, I believe that's an advantage. And just the discipline of the routines that you have to adopt, you know, during a polar journey as well, all that was, I guess, instilled in me from quite a young age.
I'd have thought most people, having done a trip like that once, would be enough. But then 5 or 6 years later, you led a team of 5 Army reservists on another 67-day, 1,100-mile traverse of Antarctica, skiing unsupported to the South Pole. How terrifying is it on those trips? The cold, the potential hunger, the fear of frostbite, getting lost, a blizzard. Do you get scared?
You do. And I, on that first trip, the one you mentioned in 2011, I went with a guy called Henry Worsley, and I swore blind when we got to the South Pole. It was such a grueling and difficult journey, and I got a bit of frostbite in my fingers, and I just made so many mistakes because it was my first expedition. And I got to remember getting to the South Pole and turning to Henry and saying, I am never, ever coming back to this place. It was just been like brutal. But it's funny how over time your memory kind of changes and you forget the bad bits and some of the hardships and just seem to remember the really good, parts of it, the stunning scenery and, the sense of achievement of finally getting to the pole. And then
you did it all over again 5 or 6 years later.
Then I went back, and because on that first trip, I was a team member and Henry was the expedition leader. And I learned a huge amount about leadership, from him during that journey. And I then wanted to go back and lead a team then myself, on a full crossing of the continent, which was, and that journey ended up being a tribute to Henry, because very sadly, the year before we left, he lost his life in Antarctica attempting a solo unsupported crossing.
Really?
So
did he? And that didn't put you off?
No, quite.
Because you think he'd have wanted you to do it?
We wanted, as a team, we wanted to go down and really honour his legacy, attempt that same, journey that he'd been attempting solo. And we did, and we got to the point, where Henry ground to a halt, which was only 100 miles from completing his planned journey. And from that point on, it was all about, doing that last 100 miles on his behalf and finishing the trip. So it meant a lot to us as a team to be able to go down there and complete that on his behalf.
You're raising lots of money for charity on the way, the Royal British Legion, also the Soldiers Charity. 2018, it's a mere 570 kilometres of the Greenland ice sheet. And then probably the big one, 2018-2019, the Spirit of Endurance, 56 days, 920 miles solo, unsupported, crossing of the Antarctic landmass. The first Brit to do it and only the second ever to complete this journey in the world. That's quite an accolade.
That was definitely the most difficult trip I've ever done. But I felt with all the experience, that I'd accumulated on the previous expeditions, that I was then in a position to go down and safely, attempt, say, a solo journey. And I'd never done anything solo before, so that was definitely the big unknown component. And it is, it's more difficult in a team. You change over, the lead man every hour, because when you're up front, it's a little bit harder because you're breaking through the fresh snow. You're having to, navigate. You're concentrating on the compass to make sure you're skiing a straight line towards the South Pole. You're looking out for crevasses. And then you find once you've done your stint at the front, you drop in on the back of the team and you're in a cut track, and it's just a bit easier, and you can put your music on and just kind of zone out a bit. But solo, there's
just no... a bit easier, he says. Just a bit easier. I don't think anybody listening to think this would think any of this sounds easy.
But you
did it, and you got the Scientific Exploration Society Explorer of the Year 2019 award. You have family, don't you?
I do, yes. So I've got three.
What did your wife make of it when you said, "Bye, darling"? I said I'd never go back to the Antarctic. Well, not only am I going back, I'm going on my own for 56 days. Was your wife appalled, or was she very supportive? Be honest now.
I'm going to be honest, and I'm really lucky that my wife Lucy, you know, has always been supportive of my expeditions, you know, on that front. You know, she knows how much it means to me. She knows how passionate I am about Antarctica, and I've been very lucky, and likewise, children were a little bit apprehensive, obviously, because they'd seen what had happened with Henry on his journey, but I just reassured them that I had mitigated the risk, you know, as much as you possibly can for that kind of journey, and, you know, assured them that if at any point I felt, you know, things were getting a bit too dangerous, that I would look to abort the trip. So with all those assurances in place, then I was very fortunate to have the backing of my family.
And now you're focusing, you consult for others who are doing polar journeys, you do specialist training, expedition management, you're also an ambassador for the Soldiers Charity. Are you planning yet another trip? Have you broken the news to your wife Lucy yet?
I am planning another expedition.
Where are you off to?
It would be Antarctica again. Obviously very passionate about Antarctica, and it's not confirmed yet, but I'm in initial discussions with a wounded army veteran who was shot in Afghanistan. He's partly disabled, and we're looking to I'm looking to guide him from the coastline of Antarctica to the South Pole. He would be the first ever disabled person to complete a full ski journey to the South Pole. So a very exciting, you know, project, and we're looking to fundraise again for some amazing causes off the back of it as well.
How many days do you estimate that's going to take you with this guy?
50. So we're looking at a 720-mile journey, and we expect it will take around about 50 days. He's paralysed in one arm.
Did he sustain that injury in the army on the front line in Afghanistan?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he was shot and wounded in Afghanistan while deployed on operations.
Well, yet again, I'm awestruck. But Louis, it's been a great privilege to talk to you. That's Louis Rudd, explorer, former officer in the British Army and Royal Marines.
Okay, the pandemic has made shoppers more cost conscious, but those with cash to spend are still finding ways to splurge the money. Retail sales have had a pretty horrific time, but the second-hand luxury fashion market has been roaring. Peer-to-peer online luxury consignment shops like Tradesay, Vestiaire, Collective and The Pod have seen a spike in sales. Delighted to say joining me now is Alexandra Payne. She's director of The Pod, who's got advice on how to buy and sell luxury fashion during the pandemic. And she joins me now. I'm curious, Alexandra, what we're seeing is people are more high-end shoes, jewellery and handbags are doing a roaring trade. Sales of rings are soaring. If somebody's got something upmarket which they want to sell, how would they get it from their home onto the market? For instance, if you're selling something, how does it come into your hands?
So we work on a basis of, we offer an awful lot of services. So we offer wardrobe detoxes, a lot of kind of personal shopping appointments whereby we will pick up items from our customers that aren't working for them anymore, bring it into our business. We don't have a store, but we actually run from online and events. And then people can buy from us and we can post it out to them that way. So we also do a lot of personal shopping appointments whereby we will take our collection to people so they can have a try at home and all those kind of bits and bobs that just make it that little bit easier to get your hands on the second-hand pieces that come through.
Would you say that the pandemic has made secondhand luxury items, there's a bigger market for it? Is that because people have got more time to look online?
Yeah, I mean, I think the pandemic has helped the secondhand market because, like you say, you do get more time at home. You can search for your consignment stores a lot easier. But I actually think, in general, the secondhand market is a really growing trend. I think a lot more people are aware of the environmental impact that the fashion industry has. And I think a lot of consumers are turning to a more sustainable way of shopping. And secondhand obviously fits that bill.
People are relaxed about wearing a pair of shoes that somebody else has worn?
Absolutely, very much so. And actually, it's becoming more and more like that. So we've had ladies previously who would sell through us, but perhaps wouldn't feel comfortable purchasing secondhand through us. And you can really see the tables turning now. So an awful lot of people are now almost kind of using a cyclical wardrobe whereby they will buy secondhand and then sell it on and purchase secondhand again. So there really isn't much stigma attached to it like there have been in previous years.
So just hypothetically, if I threw an item at you, maybe a Louis Vuitton suitcase or something, I don't know what that would cost brand new in an upmarket store, what might you be able to get it for through the pod?
So we usually price at around a third of the retail. So, for example, Louis Vuitton, you're talking into the thousands. So if you can grab something a third of the retail price, obviously it's a huge saving. And we do take into consideration any signs of wear on it, what it comes along with. So if it comes along with its dust bags and authenticity cards. But usually the kind of point that we price around is a third of the retail price.
And you presumably are incredibly fussy about what you take. If it's what we might call shop soiled or it's had a bit of a hard life, you're not going to be selling that stuff. It's got to be almost as new, has it?
It does, yes. And a lot of the items that come through us actually still have tags attached to them. You know,
because they've never worn them. They've never worn them or something. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And are you doing more business? This probably sounds very sexist, but I'm just making an assumption that you do more business with women than men.
We do. At the moment, we actually are, it's in the pipeline for us to launch a menswear line. But we've only been going for about 2 years, and we found at the beginning that women were actually easier to kind of congregate together pre-COVID to have kind of more social parties for shopping. That's kind of the ethos of what we do. We make it a very social event, and we did find that men were slightly more difficult to get into that situation, but it is something that we are looking at. The resale market for men is growing as well, alongside women. I think in general, even kids wear, it's all growing at the same time, but as a company we currently focus on women's wear.
Right, what's your biggest seller?
You know, we actually do best with clothes. We do sell handbags and shoes and accessories, but with us both being personal stylists, we actually, the service that we provide, we can actually style ladies into full outfits of secondhand clothing. So we actually do a lot better with the clothing side of it than the accessories or shoes side.
And can you do that virtually as well in the pandemic?
We can, yes. We've been doing virtual styling sessions on Zoom with lots of our ladies. Obviously, the pandemic has put a bit of a stop to the social side and to our personal shopping side in the home, which is one of our main services. So we've adapted quite quickly across last year and obviously the beginning of this year as well to make sure that we can offer online as well.
All right. Just finally, I wonder, are you wearing anything secondhand yourself today, Alexandra?
I actually am, yes.
Oh,
I am.
Go on, tell us what you've got.
I have on a pair of J Brand jeans, which I bought secondhand through the pod. J Brand usually retail at about £250 to £300, and I paid £60 for these ones.
That's a bargain.
It is, very much so. And a beautiful Herno coat, which I have on, which retailed at about £800, and it still had its tags on when it came into us. And I think I paid £300 for that one.
Very nice too. Let me know when you get the men's range going, won't you?
We certainly will. You'll be first on our list, Andrew.
All right, that's great stuff. That's Alexandra Payne, director of the pod, with advice on how to buy and sell upmarket secondhand luxury fashion.
That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. every weekday at 5 p.m. You can listen to me all over again. I am Andrew Pearce. This is The Daily Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.